Is it safe to be a Jew at Columbia University? And will Mike Johnson survive? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Noah Rothman, and a fired up and more notorious than ever MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Patriot Voices, Fast Growing Trees, and the Free the Economy podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, we got these protests at Columbia spreading to other elite colleges. The president of Columbia broke them up on Thursday last week, had the police come and take out this encampment, which constituted trespassing and was against the university's policy. Immediately, a new encampment was set up, and it's now been there for days. The Columbia president seems to be paralyzed by political fear. The faculty staged a walkout yesterday in support of the students and in opposition to their arrest, and she doesn't seem to know what to do. What do you make of it?
It's pretty horrifying, really, to think about it, because the literal chants that we're hearing in video taken from this encampment include nakedly pro-Hamas chants, like about how Hamas's fight is theirs. I listened to one chant that back and forth where Jewish students were shouted at to go back to Poland, which I take to be a euphemism for basically get in a gas chamber. I mean, I don't think there's any other way of interpreting that. It's horrifying to see, you know, it's horrifying to see American left-wing radicalism Islamified. Like, and this is a very new kind of thing, right? This is not, you know, it's slightly different than what you had in the 60s, where, you know, just taking the side of the international left and the Soviets is kind of one thing, because the Soviets didn't typically inspire lone psychos to go into clubs and shoot them up, or whereas Islamic terrorism does. So
Yeah, I wrote about this today, looking back at Columbia 1968, and the ideology then was fuzzier, not as focused as these kids are, but there's still a lot of similarities. You know, the 68 protesters were against the so-called complicity of Columbia University in the Vietnam War because they had a relationship with this Pentagon research outfit. Of course, now these kids are saying Columbia is complicit in the genocide. The kids in 68 were saying, oh, it's institutional racism that Columbia wants to expand a gym into the neighborhood where black people live. Of course, institutional racism is a big catchphrase now. But these kids are really picking up on part of the weather underground, which is more radical. I mean, they're setting off bombs, you know, here at home. But the Weather Underground Manifesto is all about U.S. imperialism and how it needs to be opposed in all its forms. And the way you decide who you're for and who you're against is whether they're for or against U.S. imperialism. And that's basically the logic of these kids as well. Hamas is anti-Western, anti-settler colonialists, so we're on their side.
Right. Although, like, I mean, just how historically illiterate can you get? I mean, what date do you pick for the Levant as whose land is it? Right. I mean, it's just, this is just totally juvenile on one level, but the level of the radicalism is frightening. And like, listen, I mean, this is historically a college that accepted a huge number of Jewish students who lived and grew up in New York City. And they're basically being told by the administration, go home, we can't protect you. Like, you're not safe here. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we've gone from college needs to be a safe space to go back to Poland in a few years is horrifying. I mean, I remember covering Ahmadinejad's interview at Columbia over a decade ago. And it ended up being a total farce. There were protests and you know, I talked to the Jewish student group, and then Ahmadinejad came on and he gave like a 60-minute Islamic theology soliloquy. And then people were leaning in and listening in, you know, like wondering like, oh, are we going to learn about like impending war? And then it's like, you know, this guy leaned over my shoulder to hear what Ahmadinejad was saying. And he just goes, boring. And then finally Ahmadinejad said something like, oh, well, we don't have homosexuals in Iran. We don't have that problem. And then the whole campus united. like Jews and radicals, like, all came together to protest his homophobia. And it was like a happy day. And, so I used to think that this kind of campus radicalism was like on its way out or just going to be a kind of stupid pose. But this week is genuinely shocking.
Yeah. So no, of course, if these were KKK supporting kids, they'd be gone in a minute, never to come back again. If these were protests saying they're two genders and they're inherent, that they wouldn't last 5 minutes. But they're playing on a sentiment that is dominant in some schools and repeating back in a cruder form some of the tropes and attitudes they're hearing in their classrooms. The 1968 radicals ended up taking over academia, and these kids are kind of their ideological grandchildren.
Yeah, well, it's social justice, isn't it? I mean, Michael noted accurately that this is such a transition from the safe space movement and the fragility that was on display on the campus scene in 2013, 2014, 2015. But it's the same phenomenon. It identifies groups and homogenizes them and applies standards of cosmic historic justice to those groups, irrespective of individual identity or individual actions. And these crowds are an expression of a familiar dynamic with crowds. Like what we're looking at on Columbia's campus is sort of an amalgamation of Elias Canetti's rhythmic crowd and the baiting crowd, which is a menacing, bloodthirsty manifestation of the reptilian brain that lies dormant in all of us. But you see a lot of the people who go down there, like Michael Powell in The Atlantic, who has a very good piece, Sohrab Omari, who has a piece in The New Statesman, who went to these protests, and they're like, well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of this menace, and they're not making any excuses for these protests. But they're saying, you know, we see a lot of the menacing aspects of it, but by and large, the vast majority of it is sort of banal expressions of, you know, sort of a modern progressive hippie aesthetic, where there's like drum circles and people are dancing and they're sharing, you know, meals and what have you. But Powell's piece was more disturbing insofar as there's an organizational aspect to this, where they have the face of the protest, who's somewhat nuanced and has media savvy, knows how to navigate a conversation with a reporter. But that's the only face you experience. There's discipline imposed on this crowd insofar as its members try not to engage with reporters directly. And when you see them on these videos, you know, chanting, burn Tel Aviv to the ground, and Hamas, we love you, we love your rockets too, that's sort of a breaking of discipline. The discipline is to try to keep these people out and physically at times. And that can be weaponized rather easily. And it only takes a single spark to turn this crowd from its rhythmic manifestations into something far more violent and far more menacing. And they're advertising their intention to do something violent and menacing. And we've seen it on campuses around the country. It's a fever, and an anti-Semitic fever is a symptom of something far worse. And we're going to see this materialize into something far worse unless college administrators and the Democratic Party, to whom they're loyal, make some examples pretty quickly.
So, Charlie, how do you think about the line here? We've talked about this in the past between harassment that should be stopped and has no place in free speech. So if there's a group of students, let's say, who don't have an encampment, are in a space, public space that's appropriate for a protest, and are chanting "Jews go back to Poland" and aren't directing it at any particular Jew who's walking by, who aren't, you know, physically menacing them or getting in their faces, is that something a school should stop?
Well, let me start by saying how I think that the people who are tolerating and encouraging this see this before I answer how I personally see it.
Sure.
I think that we are once again witnessing what is generally termed Selma envy. But I think that there is an attendant wrinkle to it. Clearly, the contemporary left, as was the case with the left that preceded it and the left that preceded that, are envious that they are not living through a great clarifying Manichaean moment. And they wish to contrive one. Where they are sinister but clever is that they have managed to deploy the logic and rhetoric of Selma in all circumstances in a manner that always, invariably, helps them. So if you are a protester protesting a left-wing cause, then you are the downtrodden victims of the violence at Selma. If you are a right-wing protester, then you're the police at Selma. You're making others unsafe. You're making the country worse. That's why we're seeing this double standard, where the overflowing of anti-Semitism into these protests is ignored in a way that it simply would not be were those staging the protest different. Phil Klein is right about this. It's not just that there is a double standard when it comes to Jews. It's that there is a double standard when it comes to who is protesting Jews. At Charlottesville, right-wingers mm-hmm. were protesting Jews. They are therefore the bad guy who are making the world less safe and horrible and etc.
But if the left wing is for president, right? The
Charlottesville right. protest. Right. But if the left is protesting Jews, then they are the downtrodden. And if the police mm-hmm. come in and try to break that up, then the mm-hmm. police are the bad guys. You can't win. You cannot win in this framework. It's extremely clever. It is now the way that our attitude toward protest operates in elite circles, of which Columbia is obviously a member. How do I see it? Well, I see it in the old school liberal way, in that there are a lot of people who don't think like this. They're very quiet or they're dead now. But there were a lot of people who came out of the 1960s who were positive toward protest and thought that it was a universally valuable thing, like free speech, and did not distinguish between protesters or the targets of the protest or the content of the speech. And you see this in the late 1960s ACLU, which famously stood up for the free speech rights of absolutely terrible, racist, anti-Semitic neo-Nazis. But that's not what's happening here. So what's my view? Well, my view is if we are going to have an open speech and protest culture, if, as you suggested, there are spaces at Columbia and elsewhere that ought to be used for this sort of thing, I'm not sold on that for what it's worth. But if that's our standard, then it has to be applied consistently. Otherwise, all you're doing is you're saying that some people get to protest in this space and others do not. I'm not sure that this is a key part of a university curriculum. I don't think that private colleges have to tolerate protests, sit-ins, encampments. I'm not entirely convinced that the First Amendment, as applied to public colleges, is originalist, but that is a different question. But Columbia is not a public college. I don't think this is imperative. But if it is imperative, if the faculty and board at Columbia disagree and they think that this is an appropriate venue, then they need to demonstrate that they're not setting different rules for some people and others. And we can plainly see that that isn't the case. Why is it that the president of Columbia is scared? The president of Columbia is scared, and supine in this case, because the president of Columbia knows that the bien pensant class, the people within the media, and yes, the Biden administration, a lot of corporations, and the rest of academia, will condemn Columbia if Columbia is seen to be too harsh toward the protesters, because those people simply do not consider pro-Hamas protesters or brazen anti-Semitism to be worthy of a harsh response in the way that they believe anti-Semitism coming from the right or speech that targets those they favor to be. And so you're getting this result.
So it just seems to me, MBD, you can clear them out last week, you know, which is the right decision. But if you're going to clear them out, you got to keep them cleared out. You can't clear them out and then stop clearing them out because you've clearly been defeated, right? And you're a coward that's been exposed as such to the world. I don't know how she can now let these protests go on in this form.
She can't. And if they want, I mean, any semblance of normal college life to continue, I mean, this is this is the time of year when students are visiting the schools that have offered them admission. I imagine like a substantial portion of the student body, actually incoming student body, actually would be horrified by witnessing what's going on in the quad at Columbia. No, she's got to act decisively and literally, I mean, in the next 48 hours, get this cleared up and cleared out. But I don't know. I mean, I have some suspicions about this protest. I mean, why are all the tents the same? And it seems like even at other colleges are using the same branded tent. Like, is there some group paying for these protests? Like, I'm just throwing it out there. There's something fishy about it, the way this is spreading from
Columbia. No, I don't know whether they're paying for it, right? But this group, SJP, what is it? Students for Justice in Palestine or something like that. It is very active on these campuses and is an eliminationist group.
Yeah, right. But it's like, is there money coming in from overseas? Is there a Qatari account? I mean, I'm just shocked at the level of how large the encampment could get in a few hours and how similar all the tents are. Anyway, she's got to clear this out very quickly or Columbia's in trouble for this.
See, I don't think that's right, Michael. I would just quibble with you on this narrow point. You say that unless she clears them out, then the college won't be able to have any semblance of normal college. Like, I think this is what she and others like, I think, is normal college. I think this is what those people think college is for. I think if you sit them down and say, tell me the history of the United States, it's about seven things, and six of them are these sort of protests.
I guess, but like, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but unlike WASPs who used to control American universities, like, Jews know how to stand up for themselves and fight back, and they will. And these people are going to be dragged in front of Congress, just like the academic scandals from last year, the plagiarism scandals and DEI scandals. They're going to be undressed. There's going to be major donors intervening, you know, major boosters of these schools intervening with the boards, and people are going to get fired. Like, I'm sorry, but I just don't think. I mean, I can't speak for anyone. I'm you know, a half Mick American, but no, I just don't think American Jews are going to put up with this.
My understanding, loosely, I didn't look at this extensively myself, is that 68 really hurt Columbia in terms of enrollment and alumni. support for a considerable amount of time. But Noah, let me go to the next question to you first. The tide of pro-Hamas protest at college campuses is rising. It's plateauing here as we speak on Tuesday morning, or it is ebbing?
It's rising. First, to the point that you made about SJP's funding Students for Justice in Palestine, it is funded and supported by the American Muslims for Palestine group, AMP, which the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies has indicated does receive covert funding from Hamas directly. There have been calls for its federal investigation into its funding. And I would add to that the Democratic Socialists for America, which organized the assault on the Democratic Party's headquarters, a violent attack designed to capture Democratic representatives of the Congress and do harm to them. These are quasi-terrorist organizations. They are not anti-war. They're pro-war. They're on the other side. They're explicit in their advocacy for violence directed against Jews broadly, designed to undermine the state of Israel. They see few distinctions between those two entities. The organizations that fund these movements are hostile to American interests. They are running afoul of the law, likely, in my view. And the institutions of higher learning that tolerate them are doing so purely for craven reasons, purely because they are afraid. And the Democratic Party is coming to an end of its tolerance for this, which is a lovely thing to see. Before Joe Biden's statement yesterday, where he sort of equated the pro and anti-Palestinian positions, which was a bizarre statement, just a brain fart on his part, but indicative of his instincts, which I don't trust and no one should. We've seen congressmen from Jerry Nadler to Jared Moskowitz, who's part of the usual suspects, to even Debbie Wasserman Schultz calling these demonstrators pro-Hamas and calling the administrators feckless. The Democratic Party is vulnerable here, and they're going to crack the whip, I think, sooner rather than later.
Charlie, we can put ebbing off the table for the moment. Plateauing or rising?
No, it's rising, and it will continue to rise. And if Trump wins, Katie bar the door.
Well, can I add one more thing briefly? Yeah. It's rising in response to Israel's acts of self-defense against a direct Iranian attack, which tells you a lot about this movement.
Amadeep.
It's rising, and I expect... I agree with Noah that it's rising in response to Israel's self-defense. It's also, I think, rising with young left-wing disaffection with Biden. And we could see, there's this nostalgic 68 memeing itself back to life element to this. So the Democrats are having their convention in Chicago this year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, there you go. Let's get it kicked off.
So it is rising. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor of this episode, Patriot Voices. This is their message to you. Here's a simple thought. Parents matter. After all, who knows what's better for children? Their parents are bureaucrats. Do you know what's best for your child? Or do bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. have your child's best interest at heart? The answer is obvious. Parents matter. Right now, Congress is advancing a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. This bill would strip parents of their decision-making authority. If bureaucrats at the Federal Trade Commission decide that a Christian video or homeschooling site is dangerous or unscientific, your family won't be able to access that material on the internet. Kids will be banned from seeing content online that the government deems dangerous. But the government's definition of what poses a threat to your child very likely is not your definition. If you believe parents matter, join Patriot Voices in opposing this takeover of parents' authority. Go to patriotvoices.com for more information and take action. Again, that's patriotvoices.com, because parents matter. So Noah, finally, and at various times against my expectations, Mike Johnson found a way to get this foreign aid bill through the House, providing aid to Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel. He relied on Democrats to pass the rule. This is sort of the underlying procedural mechanism that gets sets up a bill in the House. It's always been a party line vote, but Republicans have begun voting against their own rules. I think it's happened maybe seven times since January, And Democrats actually bailed Johnson out and voted for this rule because they supported the underlying measures. And then each of these, he split them up into various pieces, and each of them passed with a big bipartisan majority and now have gone on to the Senate for assured passage. And they'll be signed by Joe Biden. And added on was the sweetener of this TikTok divestiture measure, which the House had passed handily a while ago, but the Senate seemed reluctant to take up. Now the Senate's going to pass it as well. What do you make of it?
Yes, two things there. First, that the rules issue arises from the concessions Kevin McCarthy had to make to become Speaker, where he conceded to some hardliners in the Republican conference positions on the Rules Committee, which they've subsequently used to enforce this standard that they have adopted for themselves, which is that nothing can pass the lower chamber of the legislature unless it has unanimous Republican support, not a majority of the majority, the Hastert rule, but all Republicans for it. And if Republicans are against it, any Republicans are against it, it shouldn't come to the floor, which has compelled Mike Johnson to, you know, and Kevin McCarthy to suspend the rules on multiple occasions to get bills passed, which means you need more than just a basic majority, a simple majority. And that means you got to work with Democrats. So it's essentially the rule itself establishes that the Congress has to be what it traditionally is, which is a bipartisan institution for big, big initiatives. But just otherwise, almost nothing else gets done. That's the goal. The job is to make sure that very little legislation passes, especially legislation that satisfies Democrats. Secondly, the passage of this bill and its various tranches, I'm pleased by. I think the idea that this is giving Joe Biden some kind of an undeserved win is a bizarre narrative that does not comport with our understanding of the reality, either on the ground in Europe in the theater of war or in American public opinion. This is not an unpopular initiative. None of them are unpopular initiatives. They're desirable insofar as they replenish our depleted ordnance stocks and invest in the development of the defense industrial base, which, by the way, companies like Boeing and Lockheed didn't sit around waiting for Congress to do. The logic of demand compelled them to invest in big capital investments, big facilities designed to meet the demand presented by a deteriorating international threat environment. They know what we're looking at. None of this is a secret. So what we're seeing now is Congress finally catching up to the environment around them, and I'm grateful for it. I suspect that all the garment rending that we're seeing from the Republican side, those on the Republican side, the small members of the conference who were against all this, will subside sooner rather than later, because I don't believe it was about Ukraine. It was a proxy fight over domestic politics, over the people they didn't like domestically. And there will soon be another one of those fights they can sink their teeth into.
So, Charlie, Mike Johnson did change his view on Ukraine funding pretty starkly. You know, he was against it as a backbencher. And then very shortly after becoming Speaker, he's like, oh, I support it. And apparently, if you're to believe the reporting, it got more committed when he heard an intelligence briefings. And I think it must have come home to him that, you know, I'm the one guy potentially standing in the way of another tranche of support that could make the difference between Ukraine being able to hold the line or the Russians winning, and, you know, put it on the line here. We'll talk a little bit more about what we think his fate will be, but he's whether he's going to survive it or not, he's certainly going to have and does have a challenge from his right flank. And with a one vote majority, it doesn't take many members, and you have three saying they want to depose him.
Mike Johnson has a different job now than he had when he was a backbencher. This incident reminds me of Yuval Levin's complaint that too many people want to use institutions in American life to stand on top of and spout their views. If you wish to be perfectly true to your personal views, you can do so as a member of the House, and nobody can stop you, but you can't do that as Speaker. I've read some criticisms of Calvin Coolidge historically that noted that he had different views on the powers of the government when he was the governor of Massachusetts than when he was the president. But that's appropriate. The governor of Massachusetts has a lot more power, or at least executes a lot more power than the president, because states have more power than the federal government. Well, so here, the transition from one to the other necessitates a change in attitude. I don't doubt there was a degree of politicking here. If Mike Johnson is pretending that he personally completely changed his mind, then that is almost certainly untrue, although the reports that he will have read in his new position may have shifted him a little bit. But he is in charge of 434 other representatives. He has to take the temperature of the whole House. He has to consider not only his caucus, not solely those who shout loudly on television, but the whole caucus, but the whole House. He has to consider the American interest. He has to consider who is president, what the Senate will do, the prospects for the Republican Party in an election year, and so on and so forth. And he did that. I think it's admirable. I think you can think it's admirable, even if you profoundly disagree with this policy. Mike Johnson is the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Therefore, this question had to be interrogated completely differently than if you were Marjorie Taylor Greene, who can vote as she sees fit and speak as hyperbolically as possible. The reason that this matters, other than for the integrity of the institution of the House, is that you are not going to find somebody who can be Speaker of the House without having those responsibilities and that shift in role. Now, you might find a Speaker who doesn't behave appropriately. They won't last long. But you won't find somebody whose job doesn't change if they're elevated to the speakership. This endless quest to find someone who can live in La La Land, who can behave exactly as Speaker of the House in a House that has a Republican majority of, what is it now, one, as they might in a speech to the Heritage Foundation, is quixotic and absurd. This was likely to happen, and it's good that having looked at his options, it did.
All right. So I think I know someone who might not find it entirely admirable, but Michael's is very opposed to this package. So MBD, go at it.
Well, first, I'm curious, like, I'm just curious about the principle at work here. I mean, Charlie talked about, having to take the temperature of the whole House. Is that how people felt when invoking the Hassert rule to stop things like the Gang of Eight bill in the past? I don't think so. But the Hassert rule is this idea that a Republican speaker wouldn't bring to the floor to vote anything that didn't have the majority support of his conference. That went out the window right here, correct?
Yes, correct. But I'm not, just for the record, saying that the Hassert rule has no place. I'm saying that the Speaker of the House has to consider it in a way that a backbencher does not. And in this case, clearly that Speaker decided that it mattered more that the country was in favor of doing this, and whatever imperatives he believes exist that you don't, reasonable.
Right. According to the CBS News poll with YouGov this week, 53% of Americans support sending weapons and military aid to Ukraine. You could ask it other ways. If you ask, is the U.S. sending enough? You'll get, say, 60% or more saying, no, not enough. But that's ambiguous. Is enough for what? Enough for Ukraine? Obviously not. They're on the back foot. And if you ask Republicans, should we send more aid, another round of aid, 6 out of 10 Republicans say no. So anyway, not a single Democrat voted against the Ukraine aid bill because Democrats overwhelmingly support it. Unlike this talking point I've seen from security commentators like Rebecca Heinrichs that somehow Republican critics are joining the left. There is no left to join in opposing Ukraine aid. They're all for it. I'm shocked at how this has played out and scandalized. You know, putting aside the larger debate we've been having about America's Ukraine policy, right? Putting aside the debate whether we should take Ukraine on as a permanent dependent security and financial of the West in perpetuity, even though it's even despite its geography, history, and political composition. Put that aside, Republicans at the start of this in the Senate, led by J.D. Vance and others, said, okay, how about we tie immigration and this issue together? I don't, you know, J.D. Vance says, I don't want to vote for the Ukraine aid. You don't want to vote for border security. Let's come up with a bill that does both. Republicans send in a guy who gets absolutely trounced by Schumer in negotiations and brings forth a compromise that doesn't oblige the administration to bar a single migrant from entering the country unless they have 20,000 encounters over, like, however many days, right, it was. Some ridiculous number that has only been met a few times. Then that's junked. And what Republicans vote for instead, and what Republican hawks like McConnell exulting in voting for instead, has no border protection and in fact gives $4 billion to NGOs that are subverting our law enforcement at the border by helping migrants like ditch paperwork that would reveal them to not be eligible for asylum, or coaching them on how to get through their interviews with asylum officers, or how to avoid court dates, etc. This is like Republicans threw away the leverage for the things Republicans care about to join the Democrats in voting for something the Democrats really care about. It's shocking.
So MBD on that one, I haven't talked to anyone about this specifically, but I assume I think it would have been an obvious play for Johnson, and I'm partially agreeing with you here. Pick out the two or three real simple things you want at the border and include them on a Ukraine package and see what happens. But I assume that the difficulty was that the right flank that cares about immigration most wanted all of H.R. 2, their big enforcement bill, which is a great bill, attached to the Ukraine funding. And that just wasn't going to go anywhere. And then if you can't get your own side to unite around a compromise, then you're sort of stuck. And then some Republicans like J.D. Vance, obviously, they don't want Ukraine, but maybe they'll go along with it. They get border provisions. But there are other Republicans who just want Ukraine even in isolation.
Right. Exactly. That is true. But here's – but of course, like the vote – they want it, but they're not they're comfortable being more hawkish than Democrats. And the Republican Party as a whole doesn't seem to be there. So there is a disconnect. Now, I'm very curious. I mean, I agree totally with what Noah said, that there's an element of this where it is domestic rivalries substituting for thinking about foreign policy. I think that's true on both ends. It's definitely true of Marjorie Taylor Greene and others. But it's obviously also true of McConnell, right? Who like just exulted in defeating the so-called isolationists and populists, et cetera. I just see very little commentary saying that, well, this is going to make the big difference for Ukraine in another counteroffensive in the future. It seems much more like this is a barely a holdover for Ukraine. We're barely going to get our industrial base to supply them with everything it can crank out in the next 6 months to a year. So the mess can be dumped into the next administration's hands. I don't see any like
anyone. Can I address a few of those concerns? Cause you've raised quite a lot and I think they're all valid. First, on this vote, the vote did not get a majority of the majority support, but barely. It's like 112 to 100 something. And there were a lot of Republicans, I think, who voted no, hoping yes. And we can measure that in Marjorie Taylor Greene's amendment, where she functionally said, let's zero out Ukraine funding. If you were supportive of, not supportive of the Ukraine cause, you would have voted for that. It got about 70 Republicans, no Democrats. Second, the Senate supplemental, which is dead, dead, dead. But if you talk to Democrats about it, they would say they're swallowing a hard pill too, because it was all enforcement. There was no pathway to citizenship, no naturalization, no increased visas, what have you. So they thought they were getting a raw deal too. And the Republicans who introduced this and tethered these two issues, which have nothing to do with each other, domestic security and the provision of our support for our allies. The design was for it to fail. J.D. Vance didn't want this to pass. That's why he was pounding the table on it. J.D. Vance's arguments have gone from, well, this is not in our interest. It's not part of our, you know, it's not part of our security matrix. And also all the people who want this are the blob or the swamp or whatever. And then doing the two-step after bulking on this so that the House hasn't passed a single Ukraine aid package for a year and a half, then says, well, the situation's too far gone. We can't introduce aid now because the effects of my advocacy have been so apparent. Lastly, on the provision of this aid and whether it can be effective on the battlefield, I don't know. You don't know. None of us know. But what Russia is doing now is conscripting mass amounts of people and throwing them at the battlefield in quote-unquote meat wave assaults, a Stalinist approach to capturing ground in its ongoing offensives. And they're taking huge casualties. This is a target-rich environment for a properly equipped force. And Ukraine may be, in the near future, a properly equipped force once again, no longer having to triage its ordnance. So yes, it's within our interests to continue to degrade this force and this Russian, the Russian invading force, and providing them the means and the tools to do so absolutely can have a battlefield effect. I wouldn't rule it out. Nobody can say whether for certain it will, but it's most certainly worth a try.
May I piggyback on Noah and add one point? MBD asked about the Hastert rule, and it's a totally fair question, but I would submit that it is pretty hard to sustain the Hastert rule when the majority is one, and where there is a small clique within the caucus that is determined to throw its toys out of the stroller and bring down the speaker, if not the majority, at any given moment. The great paradox here is that the behavior of figures such as Marjorie Taylor Greene has made the Republican position weaker, not stronger. For a start, a whole bunch of serious people have retired. They don't want to be bothered anymore, leaving the Republicans with a majority of one. Second, by making it so easy to remove the speaker and then using that power or threatening to use that power, they have made, whoever the speaker is, it doesn't matter, reliant upon the Democrats to a degree that they're not going to want to be. Johnson knows that if it goes down again, he's going to rely on the Democrats to keep him there. I think the Democrats, and I criticized them fervently for it last time, made an enormous mistake last time around by joining with the arsonists and getting rid of Kevin McCarthy. I don't think the Democrats will make that mistake again, but that means that Johnson is to some extent reliant on them and is going to have to give them things. You cannot execute the Hastert rule in that environment, and there's no way that they will.
So, MBD, let me piggyback a further point, and then we'll let you take as much sure. time as you want to have the last word on this, because it's one against three. So, there is this J.D. Vance op-ed, I'm sure she saw about a week or so ago in the New York Times, and J.D. makes the best case against the Ukraine aid, which I think, you know, it's costly and it's not doable. And, you know, we just can't pump out enough munitions to keep them going. But then he doesn't really, my problem with the argument, ultimately, we've gone back and forth a little bit on this ourselves, is he won't just say, so it's fine if the Russia takes Kyiv, you know, this is the price we pay, you know, you can't fix everything in the world. He's like, no, Ukraine should dig ditches. If they dig ditches, then they'll be able to hold the line and everything will be fine. So it just seems to me that if digging ditches is going to save Ukraine, digging ditches with more artillery might even have a better chance of saving Ukraine. So the counteroffensive, I agree, it was a mistake. JD makes that case. He's right. You know, I think the Ukraine, because after the first year, they did sweep back a lot of territory, thought they could do more. They probably felt pressure to show their own people and us, you know, that they could take even more territory. But we're asking them to do this massive combined arms operation with no combined arms and go directly into really heavily fortified Russian positions and ended badly. And oftentimes in a war of attrition, and it's hard to admit when you're in a war of attrition, A failed offensive is the worst thing you can do. It's much better to be on defense. You don't need as many men. You don't need as much material to hold your ground. But I think So I'm with Noah that the odds are, who knows, the odds are this will help Ukraine hold the line, at least for the time being. That's all the best case scenario in my view, but it's better than the worst case scenario, which is Russia breaking through the lines and sweeping through and gobbling up a lot more of Ukraine. But anyway, we've all hit our points.
Is it better or worse? Is there a worse than the worst case scenario where you dedicate years more of our production lines to a Ukrainian effort and Russia still busts through those lines anyway, increasing the size of your humiliation and sunk cost, and delaying even more the rearmament and replenishing. I mean, that's the other thing this bill annoys me about, is that we say, oh, well, only $14 billion is really like dedicated to arms to Ukraine. But then we radically expanded the president's drawdown authority so that he can take all the weapons that are funded by this bill and that will come off the assembly lines and give them to Ukraine and many more besides that, ensuring that we will have depleted our stocks for several years to come, way beyond the 2027 deadline that supposedly Xi has set for invading Taiwan. So I just, we're not actually becoming more prepared. We're just being more sunk into a more ambiguous war where the main problem is manpower for the Ukrainians. They won't, they barely passed this conscription bill themselves a few weeks ago. They won't pass, as Edward Luttwak and others have suggested they do, a bill that would revoke the passports of fighting age Ukrainian men who are all across Europe and Russia too, and demanding that they fight as well. I don't know what people expect. This is running on its own weird momentum now where we're like just planning to lose bigger. Like there's no like even hint of an expectation that there's victory. Right? Like, I think if
really
if people were
why
expecting
do you say that,
why do I say that?
Yeah, you don't think anyone believes? I mean, what do you mean by victory? Are you saying you don't believe that the people who wish to send aid, they think it's going to matter?
I think that most of them, in their heart of hearts, believe this is totally insufficient to the task, even though it's probably the best or more than we can actually deliver. In
what's a speedy
time?
The motivation for sending it? Just mawkish self praise.
I think it's the same reason that I think a lot of it is, some of it's diluted. Some of it is the same impulse that had Madeleine Albright writing about girls' schools in Afghanistan 3 weeks before we exited. Just sort of this, yeah, exactly, a mawkish commitment to sentiment that has no attachment to the reality on the ground.
Sort of like the Ukraine, waving the Ukrainian flag on the floor of the house kind of sentiment.
And listen.
You think Andy McCarthy is strongly in favor of Ukraine aid because he is mawkish and self-praising?
No, I think a lot of people have convinced themselves that somehow Russia, which has not been able to get anywhere near Kiev, even though most of the intelligence agencies expected they'd get there in days.
Michael, that's not true. The invasion in 2022 was on the way to Kiev. If they didn't bottle themselves up in this highway directly down from Belarus to Kyiv and presented very a desirable target to Ukrainian fighters, they would have been there in a second if the Hostomel raid hadn't failed, because they just managed to evacuate their defenders from that airfield in time in order to repel the offense. Kyiv would have fell.
Yeah, but they haven't been close to Kyiv in a while now. And probably MBD, I was talking to some people yesterday and know much more about military affairs than I do, who kind of doubt the Russians would be able to get to Kyiv just because the supply lines would get so long. You know, it would take a lot of manpower.
I don't think that's true either, Rich. I'm not going to argue necessarily with your mm-hmm. folks here, but if the Ukraine lines collapse and Ukraine has to conduct this big retrograde operation, there's no telling how far they could get. That would be chaos on the battlefield. And the worst case scenario is not Ukraine collapsing. It's our allies. It's our allies on the NATO frontier who would absolutely panic with the encroachment of Russian forces rapidly at a speedy clip heading towards their borders, what would they do? What would they demand of us?
Yeah, that's
would they take would they take actions into their
own? So why do we want to throw NATO's borders even closer to Russia all the time? If everyone's going to panic when Russia gets near the borders,
because they want to be there, but because those allies have sovereignty and all 31 member states vote them in.
So I promise you,
because they want protection from the only military capable of annihilating Russia, so that they can behave however they like.
Next to Ukraine, Poland. I don't think the Americans did that. I'm not familiar with the history of geography, but I'm pretty sure the United States didn't put Poland next to Ukraine.
So let me. I promise.
No, but the whole point of American policy towards Ukraine now is to pretend that we can separate them politically, economically, culturally from Russia, to whom they are attached geographically.
But the question here is whether or not we should send money and arms to Ukraine, having been invaded by Russia. Now, Poland, unless I'm mistaken, has been within an alliance with the United States for a very long time. Did nobody who contrived that alliance look at a map? I mean, was it a shock in 2022 that Poland was next to Ukraine? Did Poland sneak up on Ukraine, perhaps? Come on, Michael, this is not about some broader question, which we can, of course, debate. Russia actually invaded. That is a physical fact. In 2022, yes, they actually went in with people and material and weapons into Ukraine. This isn't about whether or not we should be friends with them. We can have that debate. We can have a debate about NATO. But they did that. And Ukraine in 2022 was next to Poland. It still is.
Yes.
That's why we're sending them stuff. Not right, because...
Guys, we're going to totally blow it out. I promise to give MBD the last word. MBD, take the last word, and then they'll move on.
Yes, and Azerbaijan just invaded Armenia and ethnically cleansed a portion of it, and we're doing nothing because it's not in our interest to do anything
there as well.
So
but that's right; it's not in our interest.
It's not in our interest to do it. So the whole point is we're debating our interests. I do not believe the United States serves its national interest by taking on Ukraine as a permanent dependent.
Why do you keep saying permanent dependent when the question here is whether or not, 2 years afterwards, we should still be sending them money and weapons when they were invaded by Russia?
I would be happy to send them humanitarian aid and all sorts.
Where does this permanent
of relief
thing come from?
You keep happy to take their refuge. Happy to take their refugees. I am not willing. I do not think it is in our interest to be in a proxy war with Russia over the question of where Ukraine aligns as a security and economic matter going into the future. I don't believe they are an asset to the West. I believe they are a huge dependent. I believe they will cause immense trouble. I believe that this is like lunatic in its dimensions. That does not mean that I think Ukraine should surrender. It doesn't mean Ukraine's cause isn't just. It totally is. I believe, I wrote a book about Irish nationalism. I thought that cause was just 100 years ago. It also was not in the United States' interest to go to war with the United Kingdom over Irish independence. Not every just cause is a cause for the American military. And I can't believe in 3 years that very simple distinction is so hard for people to grasp.
All right.
Like people say, I don't even understand your argument, Michael. Well, that's it. Not every just cause. The United States military doesn't exist to educate Vladimir Putin morally. It doesn't exist to make life fair for everyone
That's
on
not
Russia's
the
border.
Argument being
it exists
made.
For us.
We really have to move on. We got to stop. We got to move on. So, Noah, exit question to you. Mike Johnson will be Speaker of the House a month from now, and double barrel it. Mike Johnson will be Speaker of the House in January. Yes or no?
Yes and yes, just because I kind of suspect that this maneuver wouldn't have been engaged if there weren't some private assurances from Hakeem Jeffries and the Democratic caucus that there would not be an effort to oust him, similar to what happened to Kevin McCarthy.
Charlie?
I agree with Noah. I also think that as a political matter, especially in an election year, it is in the interest of the Republican Party to keep Johnson there and avoid the charge, the not unfair charge, I'm afraid to say, that Republicans are feckless and can't keep a speaker in place. So
oh, wait, but the question was January.
In January. So
Republicans have to win. Election. Republicans have to retain the majority.
Right. But the,
yeah, so let's just say, that's a technical
yeah.
Let's say December.
So he'll be a speaker in
December.
In January, he'll still be leader of the Republicans, whether he's speaker or majority leader.
Right. But my point was that Noah is correct about there having been assurances made because all the incentives line up. And I don't think that's going to change in a few weeks after the election.
So Noah, you're still yes and yes that he'll
yes, yes. Yeah. Without knowing how the elections roll out. Okay. Yeah.
All right. And Charlie's a yes and yes, MBD.
Yes and yes, but I'm it's a very unconfident one because I'm not sure Republicans and their House prospects.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
So I'm going to say yes and no. I'm not certain about the no. I think I take what Noah and Charlie said. Democrats, I mean, they've been open about it, right? You've had Democrats on TV saying, I'll vote for Mike Johnson. So the Marjorie Taylor Greene theory is that Democratic support will tank his Republican support. I don't see that happening. And I see this as a great act of charity on the part of the Democrats. Maybe I'm too much of a cynical partisan, but if I were a Democrat, I'd let Republicans shoot another speaker in the back of the head and take the political hit from doing that. But then I'm not sure he'll survive a leadership challenge in the Republican caucus after the election. So I'm skeptical that he'll be speaker or majority leader in January. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor of this episode, Fast Growing Trees. Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 or 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation for free. I ordered a jasmine bush from Fast Growing Trees. It's truly amazing. This beautiful living plant shows up at your door, ready to go, even if you don't have a green thumb. And you don't have to drive around to nurseries and big garden centers. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped again to your door in 1 or 2 days. Whether you're looking to add some privacy shade or natural beauty to your yard, Fast Growing Trees has in-house experts ready to help you make the right selection. With growing and care advice available 24/7, you can talk to a plant expert about your soil type, landscape design, how to take care of your plants, and everything else you need. No green thumb, again, required. This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to the editors can get 15% off their first purchase when using the code editors at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code editors at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code editors. Offer is valid for just a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply, but please check it out. So, Charlie, we talked about this for months and months and months. We finally got a Trump trial going in New York. Obviously, the Alvin Bragg case, a little difficulty with the jury selection initially, but went relatively quickly, did not drag out for a week or two, as some people were predicting. We had opening arguments yesterday. Again, we're recording on Tuesday. What do you make of it?
Well, this is by far and away the weakest of the cases against Trump, and it is weak enough to be bordering on a disgrace. The argument that New York has brought is essentially a bill of attainder. It is tailored to get at Trump. The theory's absurd. It was summed up yesterday in a headline in the Washington Post. Prosecutors tell the jury that Trump attempted to influence the 2016 election. Well, yeah, he was running in it. It's, as Dan McLaughlin has pointed out, really pushing it to argue that this so-called hush payment was intrinsically related to any of the laws under which this case has been brought. If he had wanted to, Bragg could have found a million reasons not to charge. And in fact, had he not wanted to, he wouldn't have thought about it in the first place. So you have a case that is weak, and you have a jury that is, at least in some part, seemingly ill-suited to the task. I hope that they have found enough people who can be impartial. I worry that what they have found is enough people who are socially intelligent enough to come across as if they either don't want to be there or don't have strong opinions. But this is very, very difficult from a legal and civic perspective. It is unusual for a reason. We don't normally have trials in which the person who has been accused is so famous and so liable to inspire different views, and it is so intrinsically linked to our democratic process. There are, of course, problems with juries, and it's difficult sometimes to have a fair trial when the person being tried is hated or is regarded as a pariah across the land. But this one is already something of a circus because, as with a lot of polling, the question at hand is likely to be turned into a proxy for, do you like Donald Trump? Do you think he was a good president? Do you want to vote for him this time around? Do you think January 6th was an insurrectionary act or not? And so on and so forth. You know, we've already seen what I consider to be a civic disgrace, which is people who have prestigious jobs, jobs that require credentials and a certain amount of formal education, saying publicly that they are incapable of evaluating Donald Trump judiciously, impartially, fairly. I think that is a massive cultural problem that in another era would probably be more obvious. There was an oncology nurse, I believe, who was dismissed because she said, I can't do my job. I can't fulfill my obligation as a citizen of the United States and of New York in this way. And everyone shrugged their shoulders and said, well, of course. And yes, as I just said, it's difficult. This is unusual. It's brigaded to other democratic questions. But that person, especially a nurse, the oaths that they take, that person ought to be regarded as a failure of our civic culture. When somebody stands up and says something like that, that ought to be maligned. That person ought to feel ashamed and potentially be shamed. Because you cannot have a liberal culture without average people who are able and willing to serve on juries. So from top to bottom, you ask what I make of it. I'm depressed by it. I think the case shouldn't have been brought and makes a mockery of the system. I think that the behavior that we have seen around it, whether it's from the jury or from the media, is ugly. I think some of the gag orders that have been imposed on what the media can report about the jurors and on Donald Trump himself are extremely regrettable, especially in an election year. I think Alvin Bragg should regret having brought this one. There are some cases against Trump that I think are correct, and it's important to remember he's not above the law. The documents case seems strong to me. This one, this is a sad chapter in American life.
Yeah, so MBD, the election interference, so-called, you know, and as Charlie points out, it's an extraordinary thing to accuse a presidential candidate of interfering in the election that he's taking part in, but was suppressing this information. But that's not illegal. It's what, you know, it doesn't speak well of Trump. Obviously, they had this vulnerability, or, you know, this is how he deals with such things. But the illegality or allegedly illegality has to do with events in 2017. It has to do with how Michael Cohen was reimbursed in 2017 for the payment he made in 2016, which has zero effect on the election. It didn't matter how Michael Cohen was reimbursed. It wasn't going to change what had happened in November 2016. So that's one of the a key weakness among very many in this case.
I mean, you might as well. I mean, Trump should get into office and prosecute, you know, Pete Buttigieg for wearing like eye makeup or something at a debate stage on television. I mean, it's so preposterous. And the thing that bothers me about it is too much of this kind of lawfare, and you are a banana republic. Like, you are no longer a functioning, orderly democracy with the rule of law, right? You just have, you know, you become Brazil. You become a country that is a gargantuan democracy in name, but is stalked by total political brinksmanship and rule bending and favor trading in a way that breeds absolute and total distrust in the entire system. I understand why people want to get Donald Trump, why they want him out of politics, but is very much the, you know, you want to send everyone to the remedial room for the screening of A Man for All Seasons. And would you cut down every tree, every law to get at the devil? And if you would, then the devil's going to turn right round on you, and there's going to be nothing to protect you. Anyway, it's an absurdity. And the sooner we get over it, the better. And in fact, you know, I think honest Democrats should be even angrier that Joe Biden mishandled his own classified documents, because that was by far the strongest case against Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And politically, Biden's behavior nullified it.
Yeah, they still have the obstruction on the documents, but I agree. It kind of balances up the underlying classified documents case. Noah?
Well, I don't have too much to add. Everybody said everything that needs to be said about, for example, the fact that we're litigating things that aren't necessarily illegal, in fact, aren't illegal. Part of what the proceedings are today are in large measure about the hush money payments and the capture of the story mm-hmm. by David Pecker and The Inquirer, which is not illegal. Sordid.
Yeah, and perhaps. He also is capturing different – he wasn't capturing Stormy Daniels. It's entirely different.
Right.
A different affair.
Right, a different affair. But they, as I said, it's sordid, it's ugly, but not necessarily illegal. Likewise, the arguments today about the gag orders and the violations of, I think some of those are probably specious. I'm not a lawyer. I'd be surprised if the attack retailed by Trump via Jesse Waters on jurors necessarily was a specious argument. I think that one might have gone a little too far because this is a special case. Let's be frank. It's a special case. And anybody who's involved in it is subject to a lot of national scrutiny and the scrutiny of people who may not necessarily be of sound mind. And we have to all be aware of that. It's a real risk and a real threat. And Donald Trump running afoul of the court is running afoul of the court, whether you think the court should be in session or not. It is the case. One of the things that we're seeing from Democratic commentators is apprehension over the prospect that this might be backfiring. Saw this from Andrea Mitchell, who's on MSNBC, complaining to Kristen Welker that, you know, this is blotting out the sun and Joe Biden doesn't have the opportunity to take the microphone. And you know, therefore, Donald Trump is getting all this attention and that's good for him and bad for Democrats. And we could argue with that case because I'm not necessarily sure that's true. But it's also a reflection of how deep they are in their silos, because this isn't blotting out the sun. The coverage of Trump's trial is wall to wall on CNN, MSNBC, and the New York Times. But that's pretty much it. Most major news venues that I've seen, anything that's center or center right, has focused on the trial, as well as everything else that's happening in the world, including a big war in Europe, these protests on this campus, what we've spent most of our time talking about. There's not a lot of actual airtime here left for us to talk about the Trump trial. It's just, it's shocking the extent to which they buried their heads in this story because they expected to get psychological satisfaction from it and aren't, and are very upset about it.
So Charlie Cook, percentage odds that Donald Trump will be convicted? Zero, never going to happen. 100%, it's a lock.
Well, I worry a little bit about the location. It's funny, isn't it?
If you go back let me actually add
sure.
Be a little more specific. Convicted on the felony charges.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's funny, if you go back to the founding, the founders were really keen that people be tried where they live. But in this sort of case, you know, where you're tried really, really matters. This New York jury is going to be different than a jury in Alabama. It's a different world. I worry about that jury. I do. I don't think the case is strong. In fact, I think the opposite, but I think there is a relatively high chance that it's going to yield a felony conviction.
Percentage?
Maybe 60%.
60, all right. MBD?
I don't know, more like 70 or 80%. This is just, if they got him on 31, you know, felonies for the stupid loan case. Yeah, I mean, this is... yeah, I agree with Charlie that the location matters. I mean, if we needed any proof of that, remember a couple weeks ago, OJ died, and that whole case probably changed by moving the venue to downtown Los Angeles rather than out in the rich suburbs where he actually committed the murder.
Noah?
I mean, my wholly uninformed opinion on this is probably worthless, but I think the felony charge is sort of 50-50. it's because it's such a stretch. The state-level tax evasion charges are probably stronger, but if they got that, everybody would be very disappointed because what they want is to get him on a felony charge and say he has a felony conviction. That's the whole point of this enterprise. But it is such a stretch of the statute and the jurisdiction that you may not be able to get all, you know, all the jurors. It only takes one.
Yeah, I guess I'm around 70 with, I don't know, most of that 30% being the possibility of a hung jury. There is potential. There's one and two in there. I'm just going to say this is BS. Sorry, just not going to do it. And then there's some potential that the charges being busted back down to a misdemeanor, which would present legal problems because the statute of limitations is supposed to expires after 2 years on the misdemeanor charges, which is one reason that Bragg had to try to get this up to a felony. With that, let's hear from our final sponsor this episode. Our friends from the Competitive Enterprise Institute have all new episodes of their breakout Free the Economy podcast. If you're not already listening to the show, Free the Economy is a weekly podcast hosted by Richard Morrison that explores opportunities for financial success and self-fulfillment in a world with less government control. Each episode host, Richard Morrison, offers news and analysis on the economy and fascinating conversations with experts on topics ranging from the future of artificial intelligence to the perils of a central bank digital currency. Think of the podcast as big ideas meets real world application in ways that makes our economy happier, healthier, and wealthier. So check out Free the Economy wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CEI.org/free the economy. That's CEI.org/free the economy. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you've been very pleased over the rejuvenation of the New York Mets, who many of us were ready to pronounce dead after the first week of it.
Hoping to pronounce dead.
I was pronouncing them dead, yeah. Ever since my son and I went, they've been running pretty hot. They once,
you're bearing the lead on that visit with your son, by the way.
Yeah, my son and I went on my birthday. My wife bought us tickets at the last minute on StubHub. Really good tickets, and my son was able to snag a signature from our star shortstop and Francisco Lindor, one of about four signatures that were given out before the game. So that was his first game, and it will go down in memory, eternal, I think, in his household. And since then, they've been hot. They lost their last game in Los Angeles, but they're a winning record team, winning team now, and they've been a lot of fun to watch. The offense is really, really kicking. So I'm back in. They've pulled me back in.
All right. Noah, three words: global thermonuclear war.
Oh, God, your Jerry. Parties are getting out of control now.
Yeah, that's how we roll. We do it big. We don't do it small. So I'm going on vacation for 2 weeks next week, and I was buying some books for myself to actually read for fun. I bought the second part of the Three-Body Problem series, and I picked up Annie Jacobson's latest Nuclear War, A Scenario. I like this stuff. I like nuclear deterrence and the theory and the posturing and the history of it. And Annie's narrative, and it is a narrative, it's a fictional narrative, but it's science fiction in the classic sense, very well informed. And it is a little overwrought at times, very dramatic, and kind of this man from Mars look at our nuclear arsenal and saying, can you even believe that we have these sort of things? But it informs her narrative, which is very compelling. I inhaled this book over 4 or 5 hours. Now I no longer have a vacation read. I got to go buy another book. So I just picked up, I saw behind you, Rich, your Modern Times, which I have not read. So I bought that.
Oh, well, you have a
treat. On a lark here.
You have a treat.
But yeah, ahead of you. You recommend it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things. But yeah, Nuclear War, A Scenario, very compelling read about this 2-hour event that culminates in a global thermonuclear exchange. And a lot of, she assumes a lot of things that make it the worst case scenario, but it is the worst case scenario. And it's a very compelling read. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, pick it up.
Charlie, you fixed your golf cart.
Yeah. Sorry, I just can't get over the fact Noah reads books about nuclear holocaust.
For fun. And it was fun.
Now you're going to replace it with Modern Times, which is a great book, but not a beach read.
I have not read it.
I did fix my golf cart. I told the listeners to my podcast that the batteries had died 3 times in a row. So I spent quite a lot of time pushing my golf cart back in 85 degree weather, a couple of miles each time. The distance gets longer every time I tell the story, of course. But I wrote to the
That's got to be kind of humiliating, right, too, when you're pushing it and all these other golf carts are zooming past.
Yeah, no, that's right. Thanks for reminding me of that. That's very welcome. I wrote to the manufacturer of the batteries, and they said, yeah, they both seem to be gone. And they sent me 2 new ones, which was great. So I put them in. And while I had the whole thing open, I put LED lights underneath it that can be tuned to any color. And now my kids love it, because when we drive the golf cart at night and you turn on the lights, it looks like Mario Kart on Rainbow Road. So all's well that ends well.
So on the recommendation of a friend, I went to Battleship Cove in Fall River, Massachusetts. They have a destroyer, a sub that's under renovations, they can't actually visit, and the USS Massachusetts, a battleship. And this thing, what a behemoth. What a beast. This honk of steel with these enormous guns, just like bristling with guns all over the place. So what an amazing weapon of war. This outfit that runs this operation, this little museum, could use a little more funding, it seems. Like the ships could use a paint job here or there, and they could probably do with more with what they got. But still, there are a lot of people when I was there the other day, and it's an amazing experience. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece by Noah Rothman outlining what I've come to think of as the NR's theory of the 2024 election, which is that Donald Trump's strength is found in voters who might not show up on election day. That there are all these polls showing Trump's surprising strength among Hispanic and Black voters, and other downscale voters. But when you screen for their enthusiasm or their election, their voting history, suddenly Joe Biden looks competitive again. And this is just something I think we in particular have all kind of talked about. And I think Noah makes the best presentation of the facts. And this is the theory I'll be going into election night looking to prove or disprove.
Noah.
Thank you, Michael. My piece is Jim Garrity's Morning Jolt from yesterday. No, the desire to arm our allies does not make one a warmonger. It's one of these pieces where I'm just pounding the table the whole time. Every other line was like a yes line. Yes, queen.
MBD was pounding the table reading that piece, too.
Thanks to show off.
But one of the points he makes, and I think is really valuable to make, is that all these arguments that we're hearing from Ukraine skeptics, particularly on the right, will be, in my view, used to justify a more neutral stance vis-a-vis Taiwan in the event that there is a crisis in the Strait. They all apply. They're all applicable. And Jim rightly notes and minces no words in saying that quite a few of these arguments of the people who are positioning themselves as hard-nosed realists are masquerading as such and are really just non-interventionists to their core and are not bold enough in those in their convictions to make those arguments honestly.
Charlie.
I'm going to pick Jeff Blair's piece, which went up early this morning. What began at Columbia may climax in Chicago, in which he draws a parallel between the events of 1968, which also took place at Columbia, and at the DNC, which was held that year in Chicago. Well, the DNC is being held this year in Chicago, and Jeff thinks it seems probable that we may see the same sort of chaos as was the case then.
So my pick is Andy McCarthy's piece, Alvin Bragg, Election Denier, going to the point that we were just discussing a little while ago, that Bragg has a theory that Trump did something terrible to steal the 2016 election based on his bookkeeping in 2017. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Patriot Voices, Fast Growing Trees, and Free the Economy. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.